Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the global pandemic is truly devastating parts of the global south. We first explore how Latin American countries are handling the devastation of the COVID-19 pandemic. We begin with the two largest nations, Mexico and Brazil. We then turn to Kenya and explore one company's creative model to aid vulnerable populations in Nairobi in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. COVID-19 is a truly global pandemic, as cases are present in every nation in the world. But the threats to the health, well-being, and economic prospects are particularly salient across Latin America. We will examine the current status and threats from COVID-19 in two Latin American countries today, Mexico and Brazil. We will then explore how best these nations can survive and rebuild during and after this pandemic. Our guests are Pamela K. Starr. She's the director of the U.S.-Mexico Network, a university fellow at the USC Center on Public Diplomacy, and professor of the practice at the University of Southern California. She's the co-editor of Markets and Democracy in Latin America, Conflict or Convergence. And Erica Resende, associate professor of international relations and security studies at the Brazilian War College in Rio de Janeiro. She's the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations, Theories, Cases, and Debates, and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. Professor Starr, I'll ask you the first question. What is sort of the current status of the COVID outbreak across Mexico?
It's actually improved dramatically over the last few weeks. About a month ago, Mexico was having about 1,400 new deaths a day, and it's now down to under 700 deaths a day. There's a big concern that they'll have a fourth wave following the Easter break. Mexico is a very family-based culture, as most Latin America is, and there have been images of people cramming into airports and cramming on beaches to enjoy the holiday, and obviously also having meals with families. So there's a concern that there might be a fourth wave. But right now, things are getting better. The vaccination process is also moving forward in Mexico. They've done most of the medical personnel, although not at private hospitals, and they are doing in Mexico City, all of the senior citizens. So they're about halfway to two-thirds of the way through doing the senior citizens in Mexico City.
So some fairly rare good news, especially considering the nature of the outbreak across the country throughout the last year. Erica Resende, can you give us an update on what's been going on in Brazil with respect to COVID?
Brazil has become the hotspot for infections today. We are now surfing, I believe, which is the third wave. So we're now after 1 year into the pandemic. We have never had so many deaths, so many people infected on a daily basis. The numbers have gone up from deaths have gone up 43% comparing to 7 days ago. And so far, Brazil has registered 325,000 deaths since the beginning of the pandemic, and a little under 13 million infections, official numbers. The vaccination began very slowly, mostly because the president, Jair Bolsonaro, the federal government, the Ministry of Health, have taken too long to sign contracts with for vaccine delivery. The contracts were Pfizer, for example, offered Brazil back in August to begin receiving a vaccine as of December, but the Minister of Health did not respond to the three times the Pfizer sent letters and offers of contract. So it took quite a while. So the one particular characteristic emerging from that is an acknowledgement of Bolsonaro's own negationism against and against science, and how this affected public policy regarding vaccination and the handling of the pandemic. So far, only not even 9% of the Brazilian population received the first dose, which translates to 18.5 million people. about 2.5 received the second dose. But yesterday, the first time Brazil was able to give 1 million shots per day, because some studies have already suggested that Brazil has the capacity to vaccinate about 3 million people per day. But the main problem is the lack of vaccines. We're receiving so far most of our vaccines from CoronaVac from China, produced and bottled here in Brazil. And Oxford AstraZeneca, about a third of what we received so far.
So Pamela Starr, Erica Resende raised governance issues as a primary sort of, you know, cause for Brazil's difficulty in managing the crisis. How does Mexico's government, in particular, you know, Mexico's president and his administration, how effective have they been at managing the crisis?
They have been, up until recently, profoundly ineffective. Things have turned around in the last month or so, but Mexico just announced or just revised their figures that they have 310,000 deaths from coronavirus estimated. That makes it one of the worst outbreaks in the world in per capita numbers. And part of the reason you had such a bad outbreak is that the government sent really mixed messages to the public about mask wearing, about social distancing, and about staying home. The Mexican president himself refuses to this day to wear a mask despite having had COVID. Even when they were talking about the need for social distancing, he argued that Mexicans still needed to hug one another. And therefore, we are Mexicans, we won't do it. And indeed, he had an amulet he brought out in one press conference saying, this will protect me from COVID. But also Mexico has a very large informal economy. And because of that, lockdowns don't work very well. That's a problem throughout Latin America, not unique to Mexico. So that combination made it very hard to fight the virus. And it was, it has been very, very pronounced, very profound in Mexico. It's not 6 degrees of separation. It's typically one or two where you know somebody who has died from the virus. That being said, the foreign ministry was very effective at signing contracts for vaccine. And Mexico has vaccine from Russia, from China, from the UK, from the United States, and indeed is going to start producing the AstraZeneca vaccine at the end of the month. It'll start being produced in Mexico City. So they did get access to the virus very effectively. But the rollout of the vaccination has also been slow and problematic. So a lot of flaws in the response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, it seems like one of the most significant variables is access to the vaccine. And if Mexico is able to produce its own vaccine, I would imagine that should have a very positive effect. Erica Resende, are the Brazilians producing their own vaccines? And are there hopes that things could change?
Well, I think the scenario here is really dark. I heard talking about mixed messages. The same thing is happening over here, because there is a struggle between what it's being decided at the federal level within Bolsonaro government. Today we are at our fourth Minister of Health, and things are not working well. At the same time, at the more of a micro local level, governors and mayors are working more in tandem. But there's a clash between the federal and the local government. And most of the time, the Supreme Court has to interfere, or lawsuits are brought to the Supreme Court for final decision. And the Supreme Court, and most recently, Congress has been trying to detangle that confusion. And one of the results was that on Monday, the Minister of Foreign Affairs was ousted, replaced for another one, because Congress, Parliament blamed him for not looking at trying to secure or helping to secure vaccine deals, and even worse, actively working against securing the contract. Our former foreign minister mistreated and have been antagonizing Chinese government for the last 2 years. Brazil has voted against a call by India and South Africa to break or to try to regarding the trade related intellectual property rights and try to break the patents. And at the same time, what I think is very much will be if in the next few years when we look back at this period right now is the against science, against common sense. President refuses to wear masks, the same thing, talks against vaccination, against social distance, against any measures of lockdown, and pushing for preventive treatment of COVID. It's called a COVID kit, mostly made up of chloroquine and other medication that has already been disproved by science. And again, I think also one very acute understanding here is that how things derailed so fast, because everything Brazil back a year ago pointed that we could make it through this pandemic. Brazil had a higher rate of intensive care unit beds, a ratio by the population, not excellent like Germany, I think it had, but it was above average if you compared different countries. Brazil had a very well-recognized, established vaccination program. We are able to vaccinate 1-2 million people per day historically. So everything we thought, okay, this maybe we would not be so badly hit. But I think politics, populist politics, came into way in a very damaging, serious way.
And one thing the two countries have in common is this populist streak within their politics. How much of the Mexican government's response, particularly the president's response, President AMLO, was really kind of driven by this populist streak and a desire to, by denying some of the realities of the pandemic, just trying to make himself more popular by, as I said, by denying the pandemic. Is that a fair assessment, Professor Clark?
I don't believe that he tried to make himself more popular by ignoring the pandemic. It's peculiar to López Obrador. López Obrador is a evangelical Christian who firmly believed that the coronavirus was not worse than just a flu. And because of that, he didn't adhere to the health guidelines that were being emphasized in the rest of the world. Indeed, the Assistant Secretary of Health, who's in charge of managing the pandemic, is as much of a, I don't say he's as much of a denier as López Obrador, but he desperately wants to please his president. And so he has been saying things that are not helpful, that are not giving the correct scientific information to the population. But what López Obrador is doing is basically saying that the problems in the country associated with the pandemic, not just the very high death rate, but the economic crisis that has come with it, isn't his fault. He blames it on the pandemic that he couldn't have helped, but he blames it, as always, on the neoliberal conservative opposition that is trying to take advantage of the pandemic to hurt him, that's trying to take advantage of the economic crisis to hurt him, and that he's being unjustly criticized for his handling of the crisis when it couldn't have been handled better. Indeed, he argues he's handling it the best it could possibly have been, and that these criticisms are unjust. And then he turns around and goes after the media, the commentators, the politicians who have the temerity to try to hold him to account.
You listen to the Scholar Circle. scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the COVID pandemic and its effects across Latin America with Pamela Starr of the University of Southern California and Erica Resende of the Brazilian War College. So Erica Resende, like Pamela Starr just highlighted, sort of attacking political opponents who are trying to take advantage of the pandemic to discredit the president and the media, et cetera. American listeners, the narrative is going to feel fairly familiar to them. Is this familiar as well across Brazil?
He is the Trump of the tropics. A couple of things that I would like to highlight. First is that Bolsonaro actively engaged and tried to spread out a false dichotomy between economy against health. If Brazil followed the path of social distance and lockdown, jobs will be lost. The economy will be bad, will go very, very bad. Therefore, he played all the time this false dichotomy, you know, as a reasoning for not pursuing lockdown measures, for example. And at the same time, it was also an instrument in a way of shifting blame. So the pandemic has to do with Mother Nature. At the very early, also, Bolsonaro reproduced a narrative of China fabricating the virus in a lab and it's spreading to take over the world. Our former foreign minister went on Twitter, on social media, and blaming the communist virus, Comuna virus. And hinting that's all the Chinese fault. But when there was one possibility that actually developed into a real vaccine, is a research institute in São Paulo, Butantan Institute, which is over 100 years old, and maker of many vaccines, and the governor of São Paulo, who is a potential candidate for the next national elections, tried to pursue a contract with the Chinese government so that Brazil would be able to produce from the raw materials flew in from China and produce and bottle vaccine in Brazil. And the final stage of an international testing back in last year was also done in Brazil. So Bolsonaro was firmly against that vaccine because it would immediately translate into a popularity of his adversary. And that had a very big impact because vaccination process was blocked and also the registration by our, so to speak, the Brazilian FDA. So there was a huge politicization of the vaccine and how to handle the pandemic since the very early stages. And finally, one thing also I wanted to highlight is the role of the military. Bolsonaro came into power and nominated and lots of military personnel, specifically from the Brazilian army, into very, you know, first level positions of power in the government. And at first, the first two ministers of health were doctors. And he fired one after the other because those were trying to make a more of a reasonable work with the pandemic, especially emphasizing the use of masks and social distance. And he fired them and put in his place a general, Eduardo Pazuello, a three-star general, active duty, not retired. And many, many times, and you can see he had absolutely no experience in being in health or any kind of medical background, or even not, he didn't even understood the functioning of our universal public health system. And he said so on TV many times. And in one two particular instances, where Pazuello announced that the federal government would in fact contract the vaccines from Butantan, from São Paulo, the political opponent. And the same evening, Bolsonaro did a broadcasting, a streaming on his social media, saying no, he would not allow it. It was off the table again. So there was a constant coming back and forth between the minute. And eventually, when both of them, the president and the Minister of Health, got COVID, one went to visit the other at the military hospital. And they did, a streaming at YouTube. And very embarrassed. I think it was like one of the most horrendous moment in the pandemic in Brazil. A very uncomfortable three-star general sitting across the president, and the president saying, no, we're not going to do that. There will be no that vaccine from China, going to turn everybody into alligators. You don't know the side effects. And so I'm not going to allow for the procurement of those vaccines. And the general looked out. Yeah, here it's like this. He says he's the one making the decision. I have to follow. And that had a huge impact within the military. And I believe that was the first step towards a decline in the relationship between Bolsonaro and the armed forces, which I've culminated on Monday when Bolsonaro fired the Minister of Defense because the head of the Brazilian army had delivered an interview before and stating that the Brazilian army were following the directions of the World Health Organization. Therefore, they were experiencing a lower infection rate than the national average. So the next day, he wanted the head of the Brazilian the army commander. The defense minister refused. He got as well fired. And on Tuesday, the three heads of each branch of the military resigned in protest. And I think that tells you about a little bit of an indication of the decline of the support of our Brazilian armed forces to his government.
That could actually be quite profound considering what his power bases have tended to be. If we can shift gears a little bit from COVID to sort of the recovery from COVID, Pamela Starr, first of all, just how bad of a hit has the Mexican economy taken as a result from COVID? And has there been any suggestions about how to rebuild the economy as, you know, rates of vaccination hopefully are going up and the pandemic can get under control?
Mexico was hit really hard. The economy shrunk 8.5% last year. And one of the reasons it was hit so hard, the two main reasons it was hit so hard, one was because the United States was hit hard and Mexico is highly reliant on the US economy. As the old saying is, the United States sneezes, Mexico catches a cold, or the United States catches a cold, Mexico gets pneumonia. But at the same time, Mexico itself did nothing to try to mitigate the economic implications of the pandemic. There was a lockdown early on in the spring, and wasn't a fully effective lockdown, but it had the effect of dramatically undermining the activity in the economy. And as a result, Mexico has lost over a million jobs in 2020. The government could have initiated a fiscal stimulus, spending much like the United States did in order to try to mitigate the loss of jobs, the loss of income, the loss of employment, and the loss of businesses as well. But the president is absolutely allergic to debt. He strongly believes that debt makes Mexico vulnerable to outside interference in Mexico's internal affairs. In the past, when Mexico had debt crises, it was forced by the outside world to behave in certain ways economically. And he thinks that that would be the death knell to his economic reform of Mexico that he calls the fourth transformation. The idea is to purge all vestiges of neoliberalism from the Mexican economy and to make an economy that's more structured around the state and state leadership of the economy. As a result, he was unwilling to take on any debt in order to stimulate the economy. And the outcome was somewhat ironic because this is a man who has been devoted his whole life to helping the poor, to reducing poverty in Mexico, to developing southern Mexico where poverty is particularly pronounced. And yet, as a result of his decision to not try to mitigate the loss of jobs and opportunity in Mexico, Mexico has 10 million more poor people than it had before the pandemic. So the estimates now are about 56% of Mexicans live in poverty. It's a serious, serious problem. In terms of recovery, he's not going to spend money for that either. But he can thank Joe Biden for the recovery. The $1.9 billion stimulus that the United States just moved forward with, and at the rapid progress of the vaccination campaign in the United States means the U.S. economy is going to boom in the second quarter. Estimates are as high as 10%. Since Mexico exports 80% of what it exports to the United States, that means Mexico's export sector is going to boom as well. So the Mexican economy will boom in the second quarter as well. Estimates are for 5% growth next year. That still leaves Mexico 4% below where it was before the pandemic, but there's just going to be a significant recovery. One final thing on that is the problem with that is that it's going to be concentrated in those segments of the economy that are intertwined with US economy, the interdependent sectors, the export sector. Those sectors are largely located in more prosperous portions of Mexico, particularly in northern and central Mexico. It's going to leave the poor portions of southern Mexico behind once again.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the COVID pandemic, the economic crisis that's resulted from the pandemic, and the potential for economic recovery and its implications, with Pamela Starr of the University of Southern California and Erica Resende of the Brazilian War College. So Erica Resende, how bad has COVID been for Brazil's economy? And have there been any proposals, any government action to try to exacerbate the problem?
We had already been in trouble economically, in a crisis before the pandemic. So things have gone worse, but we were already in a downfall, especially if you compare and have in the back of your head and your mind that during the time where the Labour Party was in power, Lula and Dilma, especially first term of Dilma, then not so much, Brazil actually was able to have some true achievements in economically, especially if you think about poverty, fight against poverty. Brazil was able for the first time ever since there were any index of that sort to get out of the world the United Nations map of poverty and hunger in the world. So, and that was a huge achievement by Lula. But after Dilma Rousseff's impeachment and a shift toward a very strong neoliberal policies regarding economics, the economic crisis hit us very hard. So we were already surfing in a crisis, but the pandemic is making it even worse. There was the same thing in Mexico, a huge loss of jobs and income from people. I think the only segment of the part of the population, if you're public servant, you were able to secure and remain with the same pay. The shutdown of business, if you go downtown Rio, it's something it makes you weep because lots of very traditional establishments and restaurants and other shops closed down, sometimes even restaurants and cafe and bars that were over 50 years old. The place where Tom Jobim wrote The Girl from Ipanema closed. So there was not only a loss in terms of material that was lost and income and business, but in terms of things that relate to the memory and identity of Brazilian people are simply disappearing. Inflation is up again, and we are a traumatized nation if you think about very, very high inflations during the 80s, the last decade. So inflation is up, really, really up. And one also particularity of Brazilian economy is the high amount and high level of informal jobs. Informality is very high in Brazil. So people who just go out in the street selling sweets, candy, or having a small informal business, you know, and selling from their homes. And all that required circulation. So social distance killed informality in Brazil. And if you think in terms of policy, Bolsonaro made huge mistakes since he got in. And the policies, he did not actually establish or created a new policies, but he was, and he did his best to destroy and demolish policies that were in place, even from over 20 years ago. And so what we are experiencing right now, it's more of destruction of solid policies that were in place, even dating from when Fernando Henrique Cardoso was empowered in the 90s. So it's not something that he was targeting policies that were implemented by the Labour Party. It's a sort of a bipartisanship destruction all over. And we are not seeing anything being offered in replacement. So there's no plans. Ministers around him are very ineffective. Most of top level positions of power are being now offered to military with no previous experience of government. So you see very specific business sectors that have traditionally need a support of the federal government, not working at all. For example, TV and culture segments, industry. And we are right now in a country, we are in just entered April, and we don't even have a 2021 budget yet because it was not approved last year. So it's a country in a paralysis, struck by terror, clueless about where to go. And we only see this populist discourse of against adversaries, against vaccination. There's a overall encompassing a plot against Bolsonaro, and he's suspicious of everything and everywhere. And one very important thing that happened about 2-3 weeks ago is that the former president Lula da Silva, who had been sentenced to serve 2 years of jail for suspicion of corruption and bribes and all that, all his the court decisions were nullified because it has been established that the judge himself was partial when sentencing him, because evidence came out showing that the judge worked with, in tandem with the public prosecutor, the very against the Labour Party, and all his previous condemnations have been nullified. So that means that he now he presented himself already for, I think he is right now, he's in the lead at the polling for 2022. And Bolsonaro is now reacting against that. So it doesn't matter how bad economically Brazil is going. It doesn't matter all our problems regarding health, vaccination, the pandemics, and environment, because the focus is on the 2022 elections, and that's it.
So Erica Resende kind of answered this question. So the last question I'll ask of you, Pamela Starman, is the Mexican president still fairly popular, or has his popularity, you know, taken a hit? How have Mexican voters responded to the Mexican government's policies vis-a-vis COVID and economic recovery?
The Mexican president is enormously popular. He's polling in the mid-60s and has polled in the mid-60s for an extended period of time. The COVID crisis and the economic crisis associated with it hasn't dented his popularity at all. Now, if you scratch a little bit beneath the surface, people are quite unhappy with how government is operating. They're not happy with pretty much any of his policies, but they still like him. And the reason they like him is because he is the first president in generations that Mexico has had that speaks for the poor. This is going to sound a lot like the analysis of Trump or Bolsonaro, because it's true of most populists. But the people who vote for him believe that he is speaking for them for the first time ever, that no politician ever spoke for them before. And because they are so grateful to have a voice for the first time in Mexican politics, they will put up with a lot for López Obrador. He may be failing them, but every other president failed the 56% of Mexicans who are currently poor. It's not unique to López Obrador. They are willing to tolerate a lot of challenging circumstances because they've always lived in challenging circumstances. It's no different under López Obrador, but there's the hope that things will get better under him. He also faces an enormously weak opposition. The opposition in Mexico, in a word, is pathetic. They are the same old faces that misgoverned Mexico for the previous 18 years. They have the same ideas. All they know how to do is criticize López Obrador. They don't offer anything new or different. And that combination makes him quite formidable. There are midterm elections on the 4th of June, in which Mexico will elect, I think it's 16 new governors, but also the lower house of the federal legislature, a number of state legislatures, and dozens of mayors. And his party is expected to do quite well in these elections. They currently have a 2/3 majority in the lower house of Congress. They probably won't replicate that, but they will hold their majority. So interestingly, as bad as things are in Mexico, they haven't impacted at all López Obrador's personal popularity.
Well, we have been discussing the impact of the COVID pandemic across Latin America, specifically in Mexico and in Brazil. Our guests today have been Pamela K. Starr. She's the director of the U.S.-Mexico Network, a university fellow at the USC Center on Public Diplomacy, and professor of the practice at the University of Southern California. And Erica Resende, associate professor of international relations and security studies at the Brazilian War College in Rio de Janeiro. She's the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations, Theories, Cases, and Debates, and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. Thank you both very much.
When we come back, one company's creative model to aid vulnerable populations in Nairobi in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the global pandemic is affecting the global south, devastating the most vulnerable communities. In Nairobi, however, there is a company developing a creative model to aid the vulnerable populations. Just what is this model? Doug Becker explores.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hit communities all around the globe, and in particular, communities of the global south have been devastated as a result of this pandemic. Across Africa, and in particular in East Africa, the pandemic has created economic crises, the loss of life, and challenges to communities at risk. We're discussing the pandemic in East Africa, and in particular in Kenya, with Sarah Liebert, She is the founder of Kuzitu, a business in Nairobi that has found a positive way to contribute and survive during the COVID-19 pandemic. Sarah Leboo, thank you very much for joining us. First, how bad has the pandemic been across Kenya?
Thank you for having me. And just to say, I come from the western part of Kenya, which is a small rural town called Kisumu. And I've, being a public health researcher myself, I've spent a lot of time with family and friends from Kenya, just trying to talk to them about how serious the pandemic is and just the impact of it and how they can keep themselves safe. Now, Kenya has had 3 waves so far. So we are currently on our 3rd wave, but we've seen different things happen with each wave. So the 1st wave, there was a lot of, you know, people are just dismissing the pandemic and, you know, I don't know anyone who's sick and therefore I don't think the pandemic is real. And then sort of with the 2nd wave, things started to get more real and people started to, you know, wear masks and socially distance themselves. But now with the 3rd wave that's currently happening, everybody knows somebody who's at least been infected by COVID. So things are more serious right now. I know a lot of people who are sick. And as we speak right now, the government has locked down a couple of urban cities in the area and issued a curfew that stretches from 8 p.m. until 6 in the morning.
And I would imagine in some of the more urban areas, the pandemic has tended to be worse. I know Nairobi is one of the more densely urbanized, one of the most densely populated and growing cities in the world. Is it fair to say that in Nairobi and around that area, it's been particularly bad?
Nairobi has about maybe a little more than 4 million people right now. But what's really concerning is that over 60% of these people live in informal settlements. So these are settings that lack basic amenities, things like water and sanitation, maybe hand washing and soap, and maybe even food. So it's hit these areas even worse just because these are places that are overcrowded and even people who live there don't necessarily have the best of healthcare. So while it's a reality that it's hit Nairobi really badly, I feel like a lot of focus should especially go to people who cannot protect themselves, people without a safety net.
And so clearly people living in the informal settlements are particularly vulnerable. Are there other populations that have shown themselves to be particularly vulnerable to the pandemic?
Yeah, that's correct. There's just like everywhere else in the world, there's a lot of risk, especially to elderly populations, people living in homes. And Nairobi does have a lot of elderly people, but it's more so in the rural areas. So that I find is a population that's really vulnerable. Schools have been closed as well, just because children and a lot of interaction also makes them very vulnerable as well. So I find that populations as kids and, you know, elderly people. And what's also really interesting that I find is not talked about a lot is that people who are currently hospitalized for other ailments, other illnesses beyond just COVID, things like malaria, cancer, and, you know, just Kenya being in the tropical area, there's a lot of infectious diseases going on. And I worry that a lot of attention and resources are being focused into COVID, and rightly so, but I wish it was, you know, we were also hearing a lot about how other patients are even becoming more vulnerable with COVID.
I know you're approaching this from the perspective of a business owner and an entrepreneur, but how is the perception of the government's response? Has the government seemed to be, pretty competent, pretty capable in dealing with the pandemic, or has there been some criticism of the government's response?
In my opinion, and being again a public health expert, I think that the government of Kenya tried to respond fast. So just the typical public health measures of, you know, social distancing and hand washing and sanitizing and all of those things, they really went on this campaign to just talk about this a lot. But I feel like they also did a good job in locking down essential business, you know, non-essential businesses, schools, and all of that. My concern is that the economy is suffering, and that's everywhere in the world. But I worry, especially with an economy where people, you know, eat from, you know, it's hand to mouth, and I have to leave my house every day, go work, and then I can feed my family, and I have to start from scratch tomorrow. It's the reality of a lot of people in Kenya is that it's much harder for them to go hungry. They would rather risk the, you know, infections from COVID. And that is where the government is struggling to find the right balance.
You said that there were a couple of cities that had lockdowns. Did the government offer any sort of assistance to people who had lost jobs or had seen hours cut, wages cut, et cetera, as a result of actions to try to combat COVID?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Doug. I was on the phone yesterday evening with somebody from Kenya that I know, and he was telling me that, Sarah, the moment the government, the president went on a press conference and made the announcement of lockdown, I immediately lost my job, no questions asked. So the reality for a lot of people is that even when they've lost their jobs, they're not receiving any sort of assistance from the government completely. And this is a worry. For the first and second wave that hit Kenya, a couple of people got assistance from the government, but also it was marred by a lot of corruption and, you know, lack of transparency. So as it is right now, a lot of people are not getting the help that they need.
And I know Kenya's economy had, prior to the pandemic, had some pretty impressive growth rates. East Africa was kind of one of these dynamic economies that economists were paying attention to, although sadly a lot of people in the West weren't paying as close of attention to that. You said that the pandemic has really, you know, taken an economic hit. Has that hit been pretty dramatic? And are there some real fears that these growth rates may not return once we get beyond the pandemic?
I agree with you there. I feel like there's a couple of different segments, in my opinion, that I think have been worst hit. So Nairobi, first of all, is a very popular for being a startup hub. So there's just a lot of all these startups and all this expatriate community that was there pre-pandemic. But a lot of people who are working in that industry sort of had to go back to their home countries, you know, or sort of work from home, things like that. Some businesses had to close. The other segment that I think has been really hit is more on like logistics and transportation. So Nairobi, Kenya has a port, Mombasa, that serves a lot of regional countries such as Uganda, Rwanda. So, and a lot of goods that come through this port are transported by truck, long distance to these other countries. Now, truck drivers make up like a huge proportion of the people who've been infected by COVID. So that industry has been hit as well. And yeah, I think generally speaking, just a lot of people have had to work from home. And this is a place where a lot of people don't have access to like reliable internet or even electricity. People don't necessarily have personal computers or things like that. So it's been hard to transition to work remotely for a lot of people and companies.
So now in light of that, I know you have a company that has come up with some really creative ways, some really interesting ways in trying to address some of these concerns. First of all, can you tell me a bit more about the company?
I lived and worked in Nairobi for a couple of years, and not just, you know, the formal, more affluent sections of Nairobi, but the informal settlements. So my experience with coming from those contexts, I realize is a lot of the residents of those places do not benefit from just urban life. So they are locked out of opportunities such as jobs. And therefore, you know, a lot of them, you know, don't earn a livelihood, cannot take care of their families. And so I thought, how about connecting and matching people who are looking for jobs, people who have artisan skills, such as, you know, they are plumbers and electricians and things like that, connect them to employers who are actually looking to hire, who are located in the rest of the city that they will otherwise not have access to. So myself and two other co-founders, Quinoja and Chidi, we started Kazitu, which essentially is an online platform that's connecting people looking for jobs, particularly people from informal settlements and companies that are hiring.
Very interesting. How successful were you prior to the pandemic? Were you able to make make the kind of impact that you were hoping to?
We started in the middle of 2019, and we obviously had just a few months before the pandemic hit. So we hadn't set up that well, but we'd already matched about 80 companies looking for people and facilitated over 1,000 jobs. So when the pandemic hit, it became difficult. And I feel like the first level of difficulty was there's a curfew. We cannot have people going across the country. And the other thing is a lot of non-essential businesses that we worked with were shut down. But the second piece that was really crucial to our business was that we now could not keep our workers safe. So we thought of, okay, how do we have all these people we work with, they need a livelihood, what do we do? And we thought, okay, there's a need. Right now, a lot of families are stuck at home. They fear, you know, venturing outside to look for supplies. How about we use our database of workers and supply hygiene products to different households in Kenya? So we regrouped, and that's what we're currently doing.
So prior to that, you were connecting workers in the informal settlements, typically, you know, to these companies. In essence, was it kind of a jobs, you know, website that were making those connections? Or what other services were you providing to these, to these workers to try to help them find employment?
Thank you. So we think about it this way. If I need a job, essentially, I will go to LinkedIn and, you know, make my profile look nice and probably more attractive to employers or something like that. But if I live in a part of the country where I have no smartphone, or if I did, I have no consistent electricity or even the internet, so I cannot do anything online anyway in that regard. So what we did is we set up a physical office located in this settlement. So we ask people to come in, people who are looking for jobs, walk into our office. When they walk in, we ask them for two things. We want to ascertain that they have the skill sets they say they do, and we also want to ascertain their level of integrity. So once we do those two things, we go ahead and list them in the database. And then we also, on the other side, go to employers and tell employers, look, if you want an electrician next week, log on to our profile and we'll automatically match you with somebody. So that's how it works.
Interesting. So it's kind of a combination of a kind of LinkedIn with certain types of, you know, training, you know, verifications, kind of, you know, forming those connections. And you said that after the pandemic breaks, you focus on providing sanitizing products to these families. First of all, did you have difficulty securing these products? Was there a shortage of soaps, the hand sanitizers, et cetera? Because obviously here in the United States, we had those shortages. Did Kenya have the same thing?
There was a shortage. People rushed to buy whatever was on the shelves, and a lot of supply chains were cut, so we couldn't get as much as we wanted. So we had to get in touch with wholesalers and sort of just talk about, you know, our priority is to get this to as many households as possible. We're not planning to hoard them or anything. So we had to build a lot of partnerships in that regard. But an interesting piece also is that once we started doing that, you know, distributing these supply packages, a lot of different NGOs and community-based organizations and aid organizations reached out to us. They said, look, you have a distribution system, but we have these supplies. How about you help us distribute these things? And that worked out really well.
Is it NGOs? Are these local African NGOs? Are there also some more global NGOs, or maybe NGOs with an American presence as well?
No, we did work with just local NGOs and a couple of local governments as well.
Now that we're starting to look at the end of the pandemic, we're hoping, first of all, had there been a pretty steady supply of vaccines in Kenya, or are they suffering from a vaccine shortage?
I'm really excited about this vaccine talk. Kenya received its first batch of the vaccine AstraZeneca about 3 weeks ago. And since then, the government has worked out a plan to distribute this. And it took maybe the first 2 weeks, queues were empty. Nobody was going for them because there was just this strong myth around, if I get this, I think this is a strategy. Around like reproductive health, I will not be able to have children, maybe there'll be side effects. So a lot of work had to be done around demystifying just the vaccine itself. But in the last week, it has ramped up and a lot of people are getting them. And I'm really excited that there's an equity component as well. So the government has opened it up to 58 year olds plus, which is really good. So a couple of elderly folks are getting the vaccine. There is talk to also get them to, like, you know, low-income communities, people who are involved in essential businesses. So I'm really excited about that.
Sort of a last question then, since what the vaccine represents is we can now see the end of this and start thinking about what the, say, after times, after the pandemic is going to look like. Have you anticipated what the company's after pandemic presence is going to look like? Do you anticipate going back to your pre-COVID priorities, or are you thinking about, you know, other ways that the company might try to address some of these concerns?
It's really hard to imagine a world without COVID right now. And my team and I try to, you know, talk about, okay, so what happens if things sort of return to normal? But it's hard to imagine it. But the one thing that's central to us right now is some of the lessons we've gotten is just trying to be as responsive as possible to the whatever situation, whatever the, you know, the normalcy will look like after COVID. It may not be what we're used to. So we're just ready to respond to what's happening at that time. But our goal in whatever we decide to do will essentially be to make sure that the, you know, the artisans we work with, our staff, all have some sort of livelihood in the end. So that is the goal for us in whatever form that may look like.
We've been discussing the COVID pandemic in Kenya with Sarah Libu. She's one of the founders of Kazutu in Nairobi, a business, as we just described, that's come up with some very creative ways and impactful ways to address the economic concerns, finding jobs for populations that are marginalized within the city and within the country, and addressing some of the sanitation concerns at trying to overcome this pandemic. Thank you very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week. Oh,